What kind of a lame-ass answer is motion detectors anyway? I keep getting ratted on by the motion detectors in the stacks at the Newberry. Twice this week, I've ended up in the stacks after hours, and as soon as I show up, the guard is upstairs checking it out. It's driving me nuts. I don't think the proletariat would be affected much by the de-invention of motion sensors. Claire and I each get 10 points for correct answers, Charisse gets 5 points for creativity, and Henry gets to go backward 3 spaces for valuing the needs of the individual over the collective good. That puts me back on go. Give me $200, banker. Charisse gives Henry his money. Oops, says Gomez. I smile at him. It's my turn. I roll a 4. Park Place! I'll buy it. In order to buy anything, I must correctly answer a question. Henry draws from the chance pile. Whom would you prefer to have dinner with and why? Adam Smith, Karl Marx, Rosa Luxemburg, Alan Greenspan. Rosa. Why? Most interesting death. Henry, Charisse, and Gomez confer and agree that I can buy Park Place. I give Charisse my money and she hands me the deed. Henry shakes and lands on income tax. Income tax has its own special cards. We all tense in apprehension. He reads the card. Great leap forward. Damn. We all hand Charisse all our real estate, and she puts it back in the bank's holdings along with her own. Well, so much for Park Place. Sorry. Henry moves halfway across the board, which puts him on St. James. I'll buy it. My poor little St. James, laments Charisse. I draw a card from the free parking pile. What is the exchange rate of the Japanese yen against the dollar today? I have no idea. Where did that question come from? Me, Charisse smiles. What's the answer? 99.8 yen to the dollar. Okay, no St. James, your turn. Henry hands Charisse the dice. She rolls a 4 and ends up going to jail. She picks a card that tells her what her crime is. Insider trading. We laugh. That sounds more like you guys, says Gomez. Henry and I smile modestly. We are making a killing in the stock market these days. To get out of jail, Charisse has to answer 3 questions. Gomez picks from the chance pile. Question the first. Name 2 famous artists Trotsky knew in Mexico. Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo. Good. Question the second. How much does Nike pay its Vietnamese workers per diem to make those ridiculously expensive sneakers? Oh, God, I don't know. $3? 10 cents? What's your answer? There is an immense crash in the kitchen. We all jump up, and Henry says, sit down, so emphatically that we do. He runs into the kitchen. Charisse and Gomez look at me, startled. I shake my head. I don't know. But I do. There is a low murmur of voices and a moan. Charisse and Gomez are frozen, listening. I stand up and softly follow Henry. He is kneeling on the floor, holding a dishcloth against the head of the naked man lying on the linoleum, who is, of course, Henry. The wooden cabinet that holds our dishes is on its side. The glass is broken, and all the dishes have spilled out and shattered. Henry is lying in the midst of the mess, bleeding and covered with glass. Both Henrys look at me, one piteously, the other urgently. I kneel opposite Henry, over Henry. Where's all this blood coming from? I whisper. I think it's all from the scalp, Henry whispers back. Let's call an ambulance, I say. I start to pick the glass out of Henry's chest. He closes his eyes and says, don't. I stop. Holy cats! Gomez stands in the doorway. I see Charisse standing behind him on tiptoe, trying to see over his shoulder. Wow, she says, pushing past Gomez. Henry throws a dishcloth over his prone duplicate's genitalia. Oh, Henry, don't worry about it. I've drawn a gazillion models. I try to retain a modicum of privacy, Henry snaps. Charisse recoils as though he slapped her. Listen, Henry, Gomez rumbles. I can't think with all this going on. Everyone, please shut up, I demand, exasperated. To my surprise, they do. What happens? I ask Henry, who has been lying on the floor grimacing and trying not to move. He opens his eyes and stares up at me for a moment before answering. I'll be gone in a few minutes, he finally says softly. He looks at Henry. I want a drink. Henry bounds up and comes back with a juice glass full of Jack Daniels. I support Henry's head, and he manages to down about a third of it.
Is that wise? Gomez asks. Don't know, don't care, Henry assures him from the floor.
This hurts like hell. He gasps. Stand back, close your eyes!
Why? Gomez begins.
Henry is convulsing on the floor as though he is being electrified. His head is nodding violently, and he yells, Claire! And I close my eyes. There is a noise like a bedsheet being snapped, but much louder, and then there is a cascade of glass and china everywhere, and Henry has vanished.
Oh my God, says Charisse.
Henry and I stare at each other. That was different, Henry. That was violent and ugly. What is happening to you? His white face tells me that he doesn't know either. He inspects the whiskey for glass fragments and then drinks it down.
What's with all the glass? Gomez demands, gingerly brushing himself off.
Henry stands up, offers me his hand. He's covered with a fine mist of blood and bits of crockery and crystal. I stand up and look at Charisse. She has a big cut on her face. Blood is running down her cheek like a tear.
Anything that's not part of my body gets left behind, Henry explains.
He shows them the gap where he had a tooth pulled because he kept losing the filling.
So whenever I went back to, at least all the glass is gone. They won't have to sit there and pick it out with tweezers. No, but we will, Gomez says, gently removing glass from Charisse's hair.
He has a point.
Library Science Fiction. Wednesday, March 8th, 1995. Henry is 31. Matt and I are playing hide-and-seek in the stacks and special collections. He's looking for me because we're supposed to be giving a calligraphy show-and-tell to a Newbery trustee and her ladies' lettering club. I'm hiding from him because I'm trying to get all of my clothes on my body before he finds me. Come on, Henry, they're waiting, Matt calls from somewhere in early American broadsides. I'm pulling on my pants in 20th century French livre d'artiste. Just a second, I just want to find this one thing, I call. I make a mental note to learn ventriloquism for moments like this. Matt's voice is coming closer as he says, You know Mrs. Connolly is going to have kittens, just forget it, let's get out there. He sticks his head into my row as I'm buttoning my shirt. What are you doing? Sorry? You've been running around naked in the stacks again, haven't you? Maybe? Jesus, Henry, give me the cart. Matt grabs the book-laden cart and starts to wheel it off toward the reading room. The heavy metal door opens and closes. I put on my socks and shoes, knot my tie, dust off my jacket, and put it on. Then I walk out into the reading room, face Matt over the long classroom table surrounded by middle-aged rich ladies, and begin to discourse on the various book hands of lettering genius Rudolf Koch. Matt lays out felts and opens portfolios and interjects intelligent things about Koch, and by the end of the hour he seems like maybe he's not going to kill me this time. The happy ladies toddle off to lunch. Matt and I move around the table, putting books back into their boxes and onto the cart. I'm sorry about being late, I say. If you weren't brilliant, Matt replies, we would have tanned you and used you to rebind Das Manifest in Nachtkultur by now. There's no such book. Want to bet? No. We wheel the cart back to the stacks and begin reshelving the portfolios and books. I buy Matt lunch at the Bow Tie, and all is forgiven, if not forgotten. Tuesday, April 11th, 1995. Henry is 31. There's a stairwell in the Newbery Library that I'm afraid of. It's located toward the east end of the long hallway that runs through each of the four floors, bisecting the reading rooms from the stacks. It isn't grand, like the main staircase with its marble treads and carved balustrades. It has no windows. It has fluorescent lights, cinder block walls, concrete stairs with yellow safety strips. There are metal doors with no windows on each floor. But these are not the things that frighten me. The thing about this stairwell that I don't like one bit is the cage. The cage is 4 stories tall and runs up the center of the stairwell. At first glance, it looks like an elevator cage, but there is no elevator and never was. No one at the Newberry seems to know what the cage is for or why it was installed. I assume it's there to stop people from throwing themselves from the stairs and landing in a broken heap. The cage is painted beige. It's made of steel. When I first came to work at the Newberry, Catherine gave me a tour of all the nooks and crannies. She proudly showed me the stacks, the artifact room, the unused room in the East Link where Matt practices his singing, McAllister's amazingly untidy cubicle, the fellows' carrels, the staff lunchroom. As Catherine opened the door to the stairwell on our way up to the conservation, I had a moment of panic. I glimpsed the crisscrossed wire of the cage and balked like a skittish horse. "What's that?" I asked Catherine. "Oh, that's the cage," she replied casually. "Is it an elevator?" "No, it's just a cage. I don't think it does anything." "Oh." I walked up to it, looked in. "Is there a door down there?" "No, you can't get into it." "Oh." We walked up the stairs and continued on with our tour. Since then, I have avoided using that stairway. I try not to think about the cage. I don't want to make a big deal out of it. But if I ever end up inside it, I won't be able to get out. Friday, June 9th, 1995. Henry is 31. I materialize on the floor of the staff men's room on the 4th floor of the Newberry. I've been gone for days, lost in 1973, rural Indiana, and I'm tired, hungry, and unshaven. Worst of all, I've got a black eye and I can't find my clothes. I get up and lock myself in a stall, sit down, and think. While I'm thinking, someone comes in, unzips, and stands in front of the urinal pissing. When he's done, he zips and then stands for a moment, and right then I happen to sneeze. "Who's there?" says Roberto. I sit silently. Through the space between the door and the stall, I see Roberto slowly bend down and look under the door at my feet. "Henry," he says. "I will have Matt bring your clothes. Please get dressed and come to my office." I slink into Roberto's office and sit down across from him. He's on the phone, so I sneak a look at his calendar. It's Friday. The clock above the desk says 2:17. I've been gone for a little more than 22 hours. Roberto places the phone gently in its cradle and turns to look at me. "Shut the door," he says. This is a mere formality because the walls of our offices don't actually go all the way up to the ceiling, but I do as he says. Roberto Calais is an eminent scholar of the Italian Renaissance and the head of special collections. He is ordinarily the most sanguine of men, golden, bearded, and encouraging. Now he gazes at me sadly over his bifocals and says, "We really can't have this, you know." "Yes," I say, "I know. May I ask how you acquired that rather impressive black eye?" Roberto's voice is grim. "I think I walked into a tree." "Of course, how silly of me not to think of that." We sit and look at each other. Roberto says, "Yesterday I happened to notice Matt walking into your office carrying a pile of clothing. Since it was not the first time I had seen Matt walking around with clothing, I asked him where he had gotten this particular pile, and he said that he had found it in the men's room. And so I asked him why he felt compelled to transport this pile of clothing to your office, and he said that it looked like what you were wearing, which it did. And since no one could find you, we simply left the clothing on your desk." He pauses as though I'm supposed to say something, but I can't think of anything appropriate. He goes on. "This morning, Claire called and told Isabel you had the flu and wouldn't be in." I lean my head against my hand. My eye is throbbing. "Explain yourself," Roberto demands. It's tempting to say, "Roberto, I got stuck in 1973 and I couldn't get out, and I was in Muncie, Indiana for days living in a barn, and I got decked by the guy who owned the barn because he thought I was trying to mess with the sheep. But of course I can't say that. I say, I don't really remember, Roberto. I'm sorry. Ah, well, I guess Matt wins the pool. What pool? Roberto smiles, and I think that maybe he's not going to fire me. Matt bet you wouldn't even attempt to explain. Amelia put her money on abduction by aliens. Isabel bet that you were involved in an international drug-running cartel and had been kidnapped and killed by the mafia. What about Catherine? Oh, Catherine and I are convinced that this is all due to an unspeakably bizarre sexual kink involving nudity and books. I take a deep breath. It's more like epilepsy, I say. Roberto looks skeptical. Epilepsy? You disappeared yesterday afternoon. You have a black eye and scratches all over your face and hands. I had security searching the building top to bottom for you yesterday. They tell me you are in the habit of taking off your clothing in the stacks. I stare at my fingernails. When I look up, Roberto is staring out the window. I don't know what to do with you, Henry. I would hate to lose you. When you are here and fully clothed, you can be quite competent. But this just will not do. We sit and look at each other for minutes. Finally, Roberto says, Tell me it won't happen again. I can't. I wish I could. Roberto sighs and waves his hand at the door. Go. Go catalog the Quigley collection. That'll keep you out of trouble for a while. The Quigley collection, recently donated, is over 2,000 pieces of Victorian ephemera, mostly having to do with soap. I nod my obedience and stand up. As I open the door, Roberto says, Henry, is it so bad that you can't tell me? I hesitate. Yes, I say. Roberto is silent. I close the door behind me and walk to my office. Matt is sitting behind my desk, transferring stuff from his calendar into mine. He looks up as I come in. Did he fire you? Matt asks. No, I reply. Why not? Dunno. Odd. By the way, I did your lecture for the Chicago Handbook Binders. Thanks. Buy you lunch tomorrow? Sure. Matt checks the calendar in front of him. We've got a show-and-tell for a history of typography class from Columbia in 45 minutes. I nod and start rummaging in my desk for the list of items we're about to show. Henry? Yeah? Where were you? Muncie, Indiana, 1973. Yeah, right. Matt rolls his eyes and grins sarcastically. Never mind.
Sunday, December 17th, 1995. Claire is 24. Henry is 8. I'm visiting Kimmy. It's a snowy Sunday afternoon in December. I've been Christmas shopping, and I'm sitting in Kimmy's kitchen drinking hot chocolate, warming my feet by the baseboard radiator, regaling her with stories of bargains and decorations. Kimmy plays solitaire while we talk. I admire her practiced shuffle, her efficient slap of red card on black card. A pot of stew simmers on the stove. There's a noise in the dining room. A chair falls over. Kimmy looks up, turns. Kimmy, I whisper. There's a little boy under the dining room table. Someone giggles. Henry? Kimmy calls. No answer. She gets up and stands in the doorway. Hey, buddy, stop that! Put some clothes on, mister! Kimmy disappears into the dining room, whispering. More giggles. Silence. Suddenly, a small, naked boy is staring at me from the doorway, and just as suddenly he vanishes. Kimmy comes back in, sits down at the table, and resumes her game. Wow, I say. Kimmy smiles. That don't happen so much these days. Now he's a grown-up when he comes. But he don't come as much as he used to. I've never seen him go forward like that, into the future. Well, you don't have so much future with him yet. It takes me a second to figure out what she means. When I do, I wonder what kind of future it will be.
and then I think about the future expanding, gradually opening enough for Henry to come to me from the past. I drink my chocolate and stare out into Kimmy's frozen yard. "Do you miss him?" I ask her.
"Yeah, I miss him. But he's grown up now. When he comes like a little boy, it's like a ghost, you know?"
I nod. Kimmy finishes her game, gathers up the cards. She looks at me, smiles.
"When you guys gonna have a baby, huh?"
"I don't know, Kimmy. I'm not sure we can." She stands up, walks over to the stove, and stirs the stew.
"Well, you never know."
"True. You never know." Later, Henry and I are lying in bed. Snow is still falling. The radiators make faint clucking noises. I turn to him, and he looks at me, and I say, "Let's make a baby."
Monday, March 11th, 1996. Henry is 32. I've tracked down Dr. Kendrick. He's affiliated with the University of Chicago Hospital. It is a vile, wet, cold day in March. March in Chicago seems like it ought to be an improvement over February, but sometimes it isn't. I get on the IC and sit facing backwards. Chicago streams out behind us, and soon enough we're at 59th Street. I disembark and struggle through the sleety rain. It's 9 a.m. It's Monday. Everyone is drawn into themselves, resisting being back in the work week. I like Hyde Park. It makes me feel as though I've fallen out of Chicago and into some other city. Cambridge, perhaps. The gray stone buildings are dark with rain, and the trees drip fat, icy drops on passersby. I feel the blank serenity of the fait accompli. I will be able to convince Kendrick, though I have failed to convince so many doctors, because I do convince him. He will be my doctor, because in the future he is my doctor. I enter a small faux Mies building next to the hospital. I take the elevator to 3, open the glass door that bears the golden legend, "Dr. C.P. Sloan and D.L. Kendrick," announce myself to the receptionist, and sit in one of the deep lavender upholstered chairs. The waiting room is pink and violet, I suppose to soothe the patients. Dr. Kendrick is a geneticist, and not incidentally a philosopher. The latter, I think, must be of some use in coping with the harsh practical realities of the former. Today there is no one here but me. I'm 10 minutes early. The wallpaper is broad stripes, the exact color of Pepto-Bismol. It clashes with the painting of a watermill opposite me, mostly browns and greens. The furniture is pseudo-colonial, but there's a pretty nice rug, some kind of soft Persian carpet, and I feel kind of sorry for it, stuck here in this ghastly waiting room. The receptionist is a kind-looking middle-aged woman with very deep wrinkles from years of tanning. She's deeply tanned now, in March in Chicago. At 9:35, I hear voices in the corridor, and a blonde woman enters the waiting room with a little boy in a small wheelchair. The boy appears to have cerebral palsy or something like it. The woman smiles at me. I smile back. As she turns, I see that she's pregnant. The receptionist says, "You may go in, Mr. DeTamble," and I smile at the boy as I pass him. His enormous eyes take me in, but he doesn't smile back. As I enter Dr. Kendrick's office, he's making notes in a file. I sit down and he continues to write. He's younger than I thought he would be. Late 30s. I always expect doctors to be old men. I can't help it, it's left over from my childhood of endless medical men. Kendrick is red-haired, thin-faced, bearded with thick wire-rimmed glasses. He looks a little bit like D.H. Lawrence. He's wearing a nice charcoal gray suit and a narrow dark green tie with a rainbow trout tie clip. An ashtray overflows at his elbow. The room is suffused with cigarette smoke, although he isn't smoking right now. Everything is very modern. Tubular steel, beige twill, blonde wood. He looks up at me and smiles. "Good morning, Mr. DeTamble. What can I do for you?" He's looking at his calendar. "I don't seem to have any information about you here. What seems to be the problem?" "Dasein." Kendrick is taken aback. "Dasein? Being? How so?" I have a condition which I'm told will become known as chrono-impairment. I have difficulty staying in the present. I'm sorry? I time travel, involuntarily. Kendrick is flustered but subdues it. I like him. He's attempting to deal with me in a manner befitting a sane person, although I'm sure he's considering which of his psychiatrist friends to refer me to. But why do you need a geneticist? Or are you consulting me as a philosopher? It's a genetic disease, although it will be pleasant to have someone to chat with about the larger implications of the problem. Mr. DeTamble, you are obviously an intelligent man. I've never heard of this disease. I can't do anything for you. You don't believe me. Right, I don't. Now I'm smiling, ruefully. I feel horrible about this, but it has to be done. Well, I've been to quite a few doctors in my life, but this is the first time I've ever had anything to offer in the way of proof. Of course, no one ever believes me. You and your wife are expecting a child next month. He's wary. Yes. How do you know? In a few years, I look up your child's birth certificate. I travel to my wife's past. I write down the information in this envelope. She gives it to me when we meet in the present. I give it to you now. Open it after your son is born. We're having a daughter. No, you're not, actually. I say gently. But let's not quibble about it. Save that. Open it after the child is born. Don't throw it out. After you read it, call me if you want to. I get up to leave. Good luck, I say. Although I don't believe in luck these days. I'm deeply sorry for him, but there's no other way to do this. Goodbye, Mr. DeTamble, Dr. Kendrick says coldly. I leave. As I get into the elevator, I think to myself that he must be opening the envelope right now. Inside is a sheet of typing paper. It says, Colin Joseph Kendrick, April 6th, 1996, 1:18 a.m. 6 pounds, 8 ounces, Caucasian male. Down syndrome. Saturday, April 6th, 1996, 5:32 a.m. Henry is 32, Claire is 24. We're sleeping all tangled together. All night we've been waking, turning, getting up, coming back to bed. The Kendricks baby was born in the early hours of today. Soon the phone will ring. It does ring. The phone is on Claire's side of the bed and she picks it up and says, Hello? Very quietly and hands it to me. How did you know? How did you know? Kendrick is almost whispering. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Neither of us says anything for a minute. I think Kendrick is crying. Come to my office. When? Tomorrow, he says, and hangs up the phone. Sunday, April 7th, 1996. Henry is 32 and 8, Claire is 24. Claire and I are driving to Hyde Park. We've been silent for most of the ride. It's raining and the wipers provide the rhythm section for the water streaming off the car and the wind. As though continuing a conversation we haven't exactly been having, Claire says, Doesn't seem fair. What, Kendrick? Yeah, nature isn't fair. Oh, no, I mean, yeah, it's sad about the baby, but actually I meant us. It seems not fair that we're exploiting this. Unsporting, you mean? Uh-huh. I sigh. The 57th Street exit sign appears and Claire changes lanes and pulls off the drive. I agree with you, but it's too late. And I tried. Well, it's too late anyway. Right. We lapse into silence again. I direct Claire through the maze of one-way streets, and soon we're sitting in front of Kendrick's office building. Good luck. Thanks. I am nervous. Be nice. Claire kisses me. We look at each other, all our hopes submerged in feeling guilty about Kendrick. Claire smiles and looks away. I get out of the car and watch as Claire drives off slowly down 59th Street and crosses the midway. She has an errand to do at the Smart Gallery. The main door is unlocked and I take the elevator up to 3. There's no one in Kendrick's waiting room, and I walk through it and down the hall. Kendrick's door is open. The lights are off. Kendrick stands behind his desk with his back to me, looking out the window at the rainy street below. I stand silently in the doorway for a long moment. Finally, I walk into the office. Kendrick turns and I'm shocked at the difference in his face. Ravaged is not the word. He is emptied. Something is gone that was there before. Security, trust, confidence. I'm so accustomed to living on a metaphysical trapeze that I forget that other people tend to enjoy more solid ground. "Henry DeTemple," says Kendrick. "Hello? Why did you come to me?" "Because I had to come to you. It wasn't a matter of choice." "Fate?" "Call it whatever you want. Things get kind of circular when you're me. Cause and effect get muddled." Kendrick sits down at his desk. The chair squeaks. The only other sound is the rain. He reaches in his pocket for his cigarettes, finds them, looks at me. A shrug. He lights one and smokes for a little while. I regard him. "How did you know?" he says. "I told you before. I saw the birth certificate."
"When?"
1999. "Impossible." "Explain it then." Kendrick shakes his head. "I can't. I've been trying to work it out and I can't. Everything was correct. The hour, the day, the weight, the abnormality." He looks at me desperately. "What if we had decided to name him something else? Alex or Fred or Sam?" I shake my head and stop when I realize I'm mimicking him. "But you didn't. I won't go so far as to say you couldn't, but you did not. All I was doing was reporting. I'm not a psychic."
"Do you have any children?"
"No. I don't want to discuss it, although eventually I'll have to. I'm sorry about Colin, but, you know, he's really a wonderful boy." Kendrick stares at me. "I tracked down the mistake. Our test results were accidentally switched with those of a couple named Kenwick." "What would you have done if you had known?" He looks away.
"I don't know.
My wife and I are Catholic, so I imagine the end result would be the same."
"It's ironic."
"Yes." Kendrick stubs out his cigarette and lights another. I resign myself to a smoke-induced headache.
"How does it work?"
"What? This supposed time travel thing that you supposedly do." He sounds angry. "You say some magic words, climb in a machine?" I try to explain plausibly. "No. I don't do anything. It just happens. I can't control it. I just... one minute everything is fine, the next I'm somewhere else, some other time. Like changing channels. I just suddenly find myself in another time and place."
"Well, what do you want me to do about it?"
I lean forward for emphasis. "I want you to find out why and stop it." Kendrick smiles. It's not a friendly smile.
"Why would you want to do that? It seems like it would be quite handy for you, knowing all these things that other people don't."
"It's dangerous. Sooner or later, it's going to kill me."
"I can't say that I would mind that."
There's no point in continuing. I stand up and walk to the door. "Goodbye, Dr. Kendrick." I walk slowly down the hall, giving him a chance to call me back, but he doesn't. As I stand in the elevator, I reflect miserably that whatever went wrong, it just had to go that way, and sooner or later it will right itself. As I open the door, I see Claire waiting for me across the street in the car. She turns her head, and there's such an expression of hope, such anticipation in her face that I'm overwhelmed by sadness. I'm dreading telling her. And as I walk across the street to her, my ears are buzzing and I lose my balance and I'm falling. But instead of pavement, I hit carpeting and I lie where I fall until I hear a familiar child's voice saying, "Henry, are you okay?" And I look up to see myself, age 8, sitting up in bed looking at me.
"I'm fine, Henry."
He looks dubious.
"Really?
I'm okay."
"You want some Ovaltine?"
"Sure." He gets out of bed, toddles across the bedroom and down the hall. It's the middle of the night. He fusses around in the kitchen for a while and eventually returns with 2 mugs of hot chocolate. We drink them slowly in silence.
When we're done, Henry takes the mugs back to the kitchen and washes them. No sense in leaving evidence around. When he comes back, I ask, "What's up?"
"Not much. We went to see another doctor today."
"Hey, me too." "Which one?"
"I forget the name. An old guy with a lot of hair in his ears."
"How was it?" Henry shrugs.
"He didn't believe me."
"Uh-huh. You should just give up. None of them ever will believe you. Well, the one I saw today believed me, I think, but he didn't want to help."
"How come?"
"He just didn't like me, I guess."
"Oh. Hey, do you want some blankets?"
Maybe just one." I strip the bedspread off Henry's bed and curl up on the floor. "Good night. Sleep tight." I see the flash of my small self's white teeth in the blueness of the bedroom. And then he turns away into a tight ball of sleeping boy, and I am left staring at my old ceiling, willing myself back to Claire.
Henry walks out of the building looking unhappy, and suddenly he cries out and he's gone. I jump out of the car and run over to the spot where Henry was just an instant ago, but of course there's just a pile of clothing there now. I gather everything up and stand for a few heartbeats in the middle of the street. And as I stand there, I see a man's face looking down at me from a window on the third floor. Then he disappears. I walk back to the car and get in, and sit staring at Henry's light blue shirt and black pants, wondering if there's any point in staying here. I've got Brideshead Revisited in my purse, so I decide to hang around for a while in case Henry reappears soon. As I turn to find the book, I see a red-haired man running toward the car. He stops at the passenger door and peers in at me. This must be Kendrick. I flip the lock, and he climbs into the car, and then he doesn't know what to say. "Hello," I say. "You must be David Kendrick. I'm Claire de Tambell."
"Yes." He's completely flustered. "Yes, yes, your husband."
"Just vanished in broad daylight?"
"Yes."
"You seem surprised."
"Well,
didn't he tell you? He does that." So far, I'm not very impressed with this guy, but I persevere. "I'm so sorry about your baby. But Henry says he's a darling kid and that he draws really well and has a lot of imagination. And your daughter's very gifted and it will all be fine. You'll see." He's gaping at me.
"We don't have a daughter, just Colin."
"But you will. Her name is Nadia."
"It's been a shock. My wife is very upset."
"But it will be okay. Really." To my surprise, this stranger begins to cry, his shoulders shaking, his face buried in his hands. After a few minutes, he stops and raises his head. I hand him a Kleenex and he blows his nose.
"I'm so sorry," he begins.
"Never mind. What happened in there, with you and Henry?" "It went badly."
"How do you know?"
"He was all stressed out, so he lost his grip on now."
"Where is he?"
Kendrick looks around as though I might be hiding Henry in the back seat. "I don't know. Not here. We were hoping you could help, but I guess not."
"Well, I don't see how."
At this instant, Henry appears in exactly the same spot he disappeared from. There's a car about 20 feet away, and the driver slams his brakes as Henry throws himself across the hood of our car. The man rolls down his window, and Henry sits up and makes a little bow, and the man yells something and drives off. My blood is singing in my ears. I look over at Kendrick, who is speechless. I jump out of the car, and Henry eases himself off the hood.
"Hi, Claire. That was close, huh?"
I wrap my arms around him. He's shaking.
"Have you got my clothes?"
"Yeah, right here. Oh, hey, Kendrick is here."
"What? Where?"
"In the car."
"Why?"
"He saw you disappear, and it seems to have affected his brain." Henry sticks his head in the driver's side door.
"Hello."
He grabs his clothing and starts to get dressed. Kendrick gets out of the car and trots around to us.
"Where were you?"
"1971.
I was drinking Ovaltine with myself as an 8-year-old in my old bedroom at 1 in the morning. I was there for about an hour. Why do you ask? Henry regards Kendrick coldly as he knots his tie. Unbelievable. You can go on saying that as long as you want, but unfortunately, it's true. You mean you became 8 years old? No, I mean I was sitting in my old bedroom in my dad's apartment in 1971, just as I am, 32 years old, in the company of myself at 8, drinking Ovaltine. We were chatting about the incredulity of the medical profession. Henry walks around to the side of the car and opens the door. Claire, let's vamoose. This is pointless. I walk to the driver's side. Goodbye, Dr. Kendrick. Good luck with Colin. Wait! Kendrick pauses, collects himself. This is a genetic disease? Yes, says Henry. It's a genetic disease, and we're trying to have a child. Kendrick smiles sadly. A chancy thing to do. I smile back at him. We are used to taking chances. Goodbye. Henry and I get into the car and drive away. As I pull onto Lakeshore Drive, I glance at Henry, who, to my surprise, is grinning broadly. What are you so pleased about? Kendrick. He is totally hooked. You think? Oh, yeah. Well, great. But he seemed kind of dense. He's not. Okay. We drive home in silence, an entirely different quality of silence than we arrived with. Kendrick calls Henry that evening, and they make an appointment to begin the work of figuring out how to keep Henry in the here and now.
Friday, April 12, 1996. Henry is 32. Kendrick sits with his head bowed. His thumbs move around the perimeter of his palms as though they want to escape from his hands. As the afternoon has passed, the office has been illuminated with golden light. Kendrick has sat immobile except for those twitching thumbs, listening to me talk. The red Indian carpet, the beige twill armchairs, steel legs have flared bright. Kendrick's cigarettes, a pack of Camels, have sat untouched while he listened. The gold rims of his round glasses have been picked out by the sunlight. The edge of Kendrick's right ear has glowed red. His foxish hair and pink skin have been as burnished by the light as the yellow chrysanthemums in the brass bowl on the table between us. All afternoon, Kendrick has sat there in his chair, listening. And I've told him everything. The beginning. The learning. The rush of surviving and the pleasure of knowing ahead. The terror of knowing things that can't be averted. The anguish of loss. Now we sit in silence. And finally he raises his head and looks at me. In Kendrick's light eyes is a sadness that I want to undo. After laying everything before him, I want to take it all back and leave. Excuse him from the burden of having to think about any of this. He reaches for his cigarettes, selects one, lights it, inhales, and then exhales a blue cloud that turns white as it crosses the path of the light along with its shadow. "Do you have difficulty sleeping?" he asks me, his voice rasping from disuse. Yes. Is there any particular time of day that you tend to vanish? No. Well, early morning maybe more than other times. Do you get headaches? Yes. Migraines? No, pressure headaches, with vision distortion. Auras. Kendrick stands up, his knees crack. He paces around the office, smoking, following the edge of the rug. It's beginning to bug me when he stops and sits down again. Listen, he says, frowning. There are these things called clock genes. They govern circadian rhythms, keep you in sync with the sun, that sort of thing. We found them in many different types of cells all over the body, but they are especially tied to vision. And you seem to experience many of your symptoms visually. The suprachiasmatic nucleus of the hypothalamus, which is located right above your optic chiasm, serves as the reset button, as it were, of your sense of time. So that's what I want to begin with. Sure, I say, since he's looking at me as though he expects a reply. Kendrick gets up again and strides over to a door I haven't noticed before, opens it and disappears for a minute. When he returns, he's holding latex gloves and a syringe.
Roll up your sleeve, Kendrick demands. What are you doing? I ask, rolling my sleeve above my elbow. He doesn't answer, unwraps the syringe, swabs my arm and ties it off, sticks me expertly. I look away. The sun has passed, leaving the office in gloom. Do you have health insurance? He asks me, removing the needle and untying my arm. He puts cotton and a band-aid over the puncture. No, I'll pay for everything myself. I press my fingers against the sore spot, bend my elbow. Kendrick smiles. No. You could be my little science experiment. Hitchhike on my NIH grant for this. For what? We're not going to mess around here. Kendrick pauses, stands holding the used gloves and the little vial of my blood that he's just drawn. We're going to have your DNA sequenced. I thought that took years. It does, if you're doing the whole genome. We are going to begin by looking at the most likely sites. Chromosome 17, for example. Kendrick throws the latex and needle in a can labeled biohazard and writes something on the little red vial of blood. He sits back down across from me and places the vial on the table next to the camel's. But the human genome won't be sequenced until 2000. What'll you compare it to? 2000? So soon? You're sure? I guess you are. But to answer your question, a disease that is as disruptive as yours often appears as a kind of stutter. A repeated bit of code that says, in essence, bad news. Huntington's disease, for instance, is just a bunch of extra CAG triplets on chromosome 4. I sit up and stretch. I could use some coffee. So that's it? Can I run away and play now? Well, I want to have your head scanned, but not today. I'll make an appointment for you at the hospital. MRI, CAT scan, and x-rays. I'm also going to send you to a friend of mine, Alan Larson. He has a sleep lab here on campus. Fun, I say, standing up slowly so the blood doesn't all rush to my head. Kendrick tilts his face up at me. I can't see his eyes. His glasses are shiny, opaque discs at this angle. It is fun, he says. It's such a great puzzle, and we finally have the tools to find out... To find out what? Whatever it is. Whatever you are. Kendrick smiles, and I notice that his teeth are uneven and yellowed. He stands, extends his hand, and I shake it. Thank him. There's an awkward pause. We're strangers again after the intimacies of the afternoon. And then I walk out of his office, downstairs, into the street, where the sun has been waiting for me. Whatever I am, what am I? What am I?
A Very Small Shoe. Spring, 1996. Claire is 24. Henry is 32. When Henry and I had been married for about 2 years, we decided, without talking about it very much, to see if we could have a baby. I knew that Henry was not at all optimistic about our chances of having a baby, and I was not asking him or myself why this might be, because I was afraid that he had seen us in the future without any baby, and I just didn't want to know about that. And I didn't want to think about the possibility that Henry's difficulties with time travel might be hereditary, or somehow mess up the whole baby thing, as it were. So I was simply not thinking about a lot of important stuff, because I was completely drunk with the notion of a baby. A baby that sort of looked like Henry. Black hair, and those intense eyes, and maybe very pale like me, and smelled like milk and talcum powder and skin, a sort of dumpling baby, gurgling and laughing at everyday stuff. A monkey baby. A small, cooing sort of baby. I would dream about babies. In my dreams, I would climb a tree and find a very small shoe in a nest. I would suddenly discover that the cat, book, sandwich I thought I was holding was really a baby. I would be swimming in the lake and find a colony of babies growing at the bottom. I suddenly began to see babies everywhere. A sneezing red-haired girl in a sunbonnet at the A&P. A tiny staring Chinese boy, son of the owners, in the Golden Walk, home of wonderful vegetarian egg rolls. A sleeping almost bald baby at a Batman movie. In a fitting room in a JCPenney, a very trusting woman actually let me hold her 3-month-old daughter.
It was all I could do to continue sitting in that pink-beige vinyl chair and not spring up and run madly away, hugging that tiny soft being to my breasts. My body wanted a baby. I felt empty, and I wanted to be full. I wanted someone to love who would stay. Stay and be there always. And I wanted Henry to be in this child, so that when he was gone, he wouldn't be entirely gone. There would be a bit of him with me. Insurance, in case of fire, flood, act of God.
Sunday, October 2nd, 1966. Henry is 33. I'm sitting, very comfortable and content, in a tree in Appleton, Wisconsin in 1966, eating a tuna fish sandwich and wearing a white t-shirt and chinos stolen from someone's beautiful sun-dried laundry. Somewhere in Chicago, I'm 3. My mother is still alive and none of this chrono-fuck-uppedness has started. I salute my small former self, and thinking about me as a child naturally gets me thinking about Claire and our efforts to conceive. On one hand, I'm all eagerness. I want to give Claire a baby, see Claire ripen like a flesh melon, Demeter in glory. I want a normal baby who will do the things normal babies do. Suck, grasp, shit, sleep, laugh, roll over, sit up, walk, talk in nonsense mumblings. I want to see my father awkwardly cradling a tiny grandchild. I've given my father so little happiness. This would be a large redress. A bomb. And a bomb to Claire, too. When I'm snatched away from her, a part of me would remain. But, I know, without knowing, that this is very unlikely. I know that a child of mine is almost certainly going to be the one most likely to spontaneously vanish. A magical disappearing baby who will evaporate as though carried off by fairies. And even as I pray, panting and gasping over Claire in extremities of desire for the miracle of sex to somehow yield us a baby, a part of me is praying just as vehemently for us to be spared. I'm reminded of the story of the monkey's paw, and the three wishes that followed so naturally and horribly from each other. I wonder if our wish is of a similar order. I am a coward. A better man would take Claire by the shoulders and say, "Love, this is all a mistake. Let us accept it and go on and be happy." But I know that Claire would never accept, would always be sad. And so I hope, against reason, and I make love to Claire as though anything good might come of it.
1. Monday, June 3rd, 1996. Claire is 25. The first time it happens, Henry is away. It's the 8th week of the pregnancy. The baby is the size of a plum, has a face and hands, and a beating heart. It is early evening, early summer, and I can see magenta and orange clouds in the west as I wash the dishes. Henry disappeared almost 2 hours ago. He went out to water the lawn, and after half an hour, when I realized that the sprinkler still wasn't on, I stood at the back door and saw the telltale pile of clothing sitting by the grape arbor. I went out and gathered up Henry's jeans and underwear and his ratty Kill Your Television t-shirt, folded them, and put them on the bed. I thought about turning on the sprinkler but decided not to, reasoning that Henry won't like it if he appears in the backyard and gets drenched. I have prepared and eaten macaroni and cheese and a small salad, have taken my vitamins, have consumed a large glass of skim milk. I hum as I do the dishes. Imagine the little being inside me hearing the humming, filing the humming away for future reference at some subtle cellular level. And as I stand there, conscientiously washing my salad bowl, I feel a slight twinge somewhere deep inside, somewhere in my pelvis. 10 minutes later, I am sitting in the living room minding my own business and reading Louis de Bernier, and there it is again, a brief twang on my internal strings. I ignore it. Everything is fine. Henry's been gone for more than 2 hours. I worry about him for a second, then resolutely ignore that too. I do not start to really worry for another half hour or so, because now the weird little sensations are resembling menstrual cramps, and I am even feeling that sticky blood feeling between my legs, and I get up and walk into the bathroom and pull down my underpants. There's a lot of blood, oh my God. I call Charisse. Gomez answers the phone. I try to sound okay, ask for Charisse, who gets on the phone and immediately says, "What's wrong?" "I'm bleeding." "Where's Henry?" "I don't know." "What kind of bleeding?" "Like a period." The pain is becoming intense, and I sit down on the floor. "Can you take me to Illinois Masonic?" "I'll be right there, Claire." She hangs up, and I replace the receiver gently, as though I might hurt its feelings by handling it too roughly. I get to my feet with care, find my purse. I want to write Henry a note, but I don't know what to say. I write, "Went to IL Masonic. Cramps. Charisse drove me there. 7:20 p.m. C." I unlock the back door for Henry. I leave the note by the phone. A few minutes later, Charisse is at the front door. When we get to the car, Gomez is driving. We don't talk much. I sit in the front seat, look out the window. Western, to Belmont, to Sheffield, to Wellington. Everything is unusually sharp and emphatic, as though I need to remember, as though there will be a test. Gomez turns into the unloading zone for the emergency room. Charisse and I get out. I look back at Gomez, who smiles briefly and roars off to park the car. We walk through doors that open automatically as our feet press the ground, as in a fairy tale, as though we are expected. The pain has receded like an ebbing tide, and now it moves toward the shore again, fresh and fierce. There are a few people sitting abject and small in the brightly lit room, waiting their turn, encircling their pain with bowed heads and crossed arms, and I sink down among them. Charisse walks over to the man sitting behind the triage desk. I can't hear what she says, but when he says, "Miscarriage," it dawns on me that this is what is going on. This is what it is called. And the word expands in my head until it fills all crevices of my mind, until it has crowded out every other thought. I start to cry. After they've done everything they could. It happens anyway. I find out later that Henry arrived just before the end, but they wouldn't let him come in. I have been sleeping, and when I wake up, it's late at night, and Henry is there. He is pale and hollow-eyed, and he doesn't say a word. "Oh," I mumble, "where were you?" And Henry leans over and carefully embraces me. I feel his stubble against my cheek, and I am rubbed raw. Not on my skin, but deep in me. A wound opens, and Henry's face is wet. But with whose tears?
Thursday, June 13th, and Friday, June 14th, 1996. Henry is 32. I arrive at the sleep lab exhausted, as Dr. Kendrick has asked me to. This is the fifth night I've spent here, and by now I know the routine. I sit on the bed in the odd, fake, home-like bedroom wearing pajama bottoms while Dr. Larson's lab technician, Karen, puts cream on my head and chest and tapes wires in place. Karen is young and blonde and Vietnamese. She's wearing long, fake fingernails and says, "Oops, sorry," when she rakes my cheek with one of them. The lights are dim and the room is cool. There are no windows except a piece of one-way glass that looks like a mirror, behind which sits Dr. Larson or whoever's watching the machines this evening. Karen finishes the wiring, bids me good night, leaves the room. I settle into the bed carefully, close my eyes, imagine the spider-legged tracings on long streams of graph paper gracefully recording my eye movements, respiration, brain waves on the other side of the glass. I'm asleep within minutes. I dream of running. I'm running through woods, dense brush, trees. But somehow I'm running through all of it, passing through like a ghost. I burst into a clearing.
There's been a fire. I dream I'm having sex with Ingrid. I know it's Ingrid, even though I can't see her face.